Recording. So I don't know why it didn't record. It was on, it was working, but the little red light wasn't on. If you see that little red light go off, shout at me. So just to recap, it's really important that you find your name on the final URL list, which is in the core documents folder in Leo. If your URL is not there, please send it to me immediately so that you can be part of the conversation with peer reviewing. Now, with peer reviewing, please take it as an opportunity to interact with somebody else in the class, not just simply to go in for 5 minutes and say your work is great, blah, and disappear again. There are two components to a peer review that I'm looking for. One is that you courteously engage with their ideas, and perhaps you've chosen them because they're writing about something you're particularly interested in. So, good to share just a few ideas. A couple of sentences is all you need. And then, you are all, or many of you, are future teachers. Here's an opportunity to, gently suggest that something ought to be improved. Either you've picked out some aspect of grammar or some idea that you're questioning. Take that opportunity. At the end of the semester, when you aggregate your peer reviews together and put them all into that category peer reviews, I'll have a quick look through there and it'll be easy for me to see who's done peer reviews through the semester and who's done good peer reviews. And you'll get top marks for that component. In fact, the e-portfolio blogging component of this unit is the easiest way to get a third of the marks for the whole unit if you're consistent and you just do the simple task you have to do each week. Some of you go a little bit overboard. I don't mind about that. It's your way of learning. It's your way of amplifying your knowledge, preparing you for your essays and your exams. I can't see any problem with that. Any questions about that at all? No? Okay. So, I've got a big task ahead of me, and I made the task more complicated because it was actually made more complicated for me. I originally had our visit to the gallery scheduled for week 6, not week 5. And then I found out that the alchemy painting is being taken down at the end of week 5. We're no longer visible for probably about 2 years. It's going overseas. So I had to bring that forward, which means that I have to do an introduction to 3 works this week. We've already talked a bit about Marriage of Heaven and Hell, but I'm going to talk again about it today. So I'll be talking about Brett Whiteley, Job, and the Marriage of Heaven and Hell today, which is more than anybody can chew off in an hour and a half. But what I want to tell you is not to panic. First of all, we will be coming back to the Marriage of Heaven and Hell after next week. We're going to come back to it, and we'll come back to any other questions that arise from our visit next week. Most important for you at this point is just to soak up. Not worry about your lack of intelligence, etc. I've talked to a few of you already who've said, Marriage of Heaven and Hell, can't make any sense of it, help, I'm drowning. But let me tell you that the great critics of the world are drowning still in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Still.
I'm glad of that.
And this book that I picked up relatively recently, it's a new publication by Michael Phillips, William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. I'm going to put 2 copies of this into closed reserve today. And into the 2-hour loan section. But it's a wonderful book because it contextualizes the really good essay that you've got in here. You must read the essay in here by Nurmi. It gets a bit complicated in parts, but it kind of gives a good framework for understanding the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. But this essay sort of looks at that in context and looks at all the debates around the dating and the meaning and so on and so forth. So it's called, I'll make a note in Leo about all the things that I put on the closed reserve later today. But one of the most interesting facts that comes out of that book that I hadn't realized before is that people thought that William Blake wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell in 1790, because there's 1790 printed on one of the pages. But a lot of historical study has been done of the period between 1790 and 1793. Well, 1790 was the year after the storming of the Bastille and the tremendous kind of wave of support that the French Revolution got from William Blake and other radicals in England. And if it had been published in 1790, it's likely that Blake would have put his name to it. But he didn't put his name to it. There is no author on the only copies that are existent, and there are only nine copies of that book exist, and his name does not appear on any one of them. And in 1793 was the year that there was this huge backlash in England. There was a secret police out, literally knocking on everybody's door, saying, "Do you know of anybody who is involved in writing seditious pamphlets, daring to challenge the authority of the king?" And there were many, many people who were dragged off for sedition as traitors, either sent to Australia or imprisoned for many years. Blake escaped all that. It's really interesting that he did, because there are actually people in Lambeth, in London, where he lived, who knew of Blake, knew that he'd written Songs of Innocence and Experience, but he escaped. And it's partly because of his cleverness in concealing the authorship, but also perhaps his cleverness in concealing what he was actually wanting to say, which makes a problem for us. What the bloody hell is he saying? He kind of, I've mentioned before how Blake sort of went underground in his writing. He was sort of forced to go underground. And that's why several issues of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and I'm going to give you a printout of this today in the tutorials, have got this picture on the front, which is three men standing there terrified, and the title of it is "Our End is Nigh, Our End is Near, Our End is Coming." And Blake really obviously felt terrified that, he wasn't going to live for another year or so. In fact, there is a stanza in the poem which suggests that he felt that he was under threat and his life wouldn't last more than a year or so. So the political context of that creative work is really interesting and important. Now, it's important to me, what I'm interested in is the way that artists in all periods of history use their artistry to try and challenge and transform the negative vibrations that are occurring in society around them. In a way, that's a role of an artist. An artist is a kind of a transforming apparatus to kind of absorb, transform, and somehow bring creation into the picture. And certainly The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is like that. The Marriage of Heaven and Hell has so much in it about transformation, about opening the eyes, about seeing, about vision, about changing one's state from negative to positive, about the intimate connections between good and evil, about how good needs evil to really become truly ingrained in a human being. Joy and woe are woven fine. These ideas kind of echo throughout Blake. Now, when we come to Brett Whiteley, and I'm going to actually start with Brett Whiteley today, a very similar kind of context. The time of the Vietnam War, the horrors of racial inequality in America, the world seemed to be in chaos in Brett Whiteley's eyes. And he was, unlike Blake, or he looks a bit like Blake, but unlike Blake, he was a world celebrity. He grew up in Northbridge in Sydney. He was just an ordinary schoolboy, but very gifted, very brilliant. His parents sent him to art school. And he got an international scholarship to America. And he went to America, stayed in New York in one of the most famous hotels there, full of all the most trippiest, enlightened people like Bob Dylan and various other people. They were all there in that hotel where he was. And he was, But what he saw around him was horrific. And he actually did one of his huge paintings called The American Dream, which is as big as Alchemy. It's about 20 panels. But no one in America was interested in it. He couldn't make anybody. And it was a painting that really was trying to show problems and kind of bring solutions and new insights. It eventually was bought and sold to the art gallery in Western Australia, where it sits right now. If ever you go over there, you should have a look there. But Alchemy was his attempt to bring his interest in spirituality, his interest in politics in the world, into a huge melting pot to try and transform the condition of the world as he saw it. But he was so part of that world himself. You know, he was very much into heroin, into dope, all sorts of things. And as you, I'm sure you're aware, he died of a heroin overdose down in a hotel down in Wollongong, one of the great tragedies of the age. He became even more famous after that. And his wife, Wendy, she's still alive. She lives in the house, in the studio, in the house that they lived in at Lavender Bay. It's got a funny little tower on the top of it. She's recently been on television for her environmental care of the gardens around there.
He had a daughter who died of cancer.
He had a daughter who died of cancer, and he and his wife, of course, separated. I mean, they went through all the kind of tensions and horrors of, you know, living in the 60s and the 70s. I've got a wonderful film, which I'm going to show you bits of in a moment, which is Brett Whiteley talking about his own life and talking about his own art. So the plan today is to do Whiteley. I've got a paper I want to read you on Whiteley, which I gave at a conference here at ACU last year when I was doing a talk on Whiteley and David Maloof. Because I think there's a lot of interesting links between Whiteley and David Maloof and Patrick White that we'll be coming to. So looking up here for a moment, there's a whole stack of stuff here, more than you can digest in a week. But these are the images I'm going to use for the Whiteley. And then I'm going to use some of these images for Marriage of Heaven and Hell. I'm going to have a look at the Book of Job. So I probably won't get through all of that. I'll probably have to come back to some of that the week after. But I do want to make at least a kind of a stepping stone for you in each of those areas. And here are a whole lot of useful resource materials that you should dip into. Thomas Altizer is particularly interesting. If those of you that are doing theology and religion, Thomas Altizer is a theologian himself and sees William Blake as one of the most significant theological reawakenings of his time. Okay, so let's go to Whiteley first of all. Now, is it getting a bit stuffy in here, or am I just getting overheated? What's the general temperature feeling? Is it aircon or not? It's good. Must be getting overheated. If you need aircon, just yell out and we'll turn it on back there. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is I will be happy to extend the deadline of this essay by a week, because of the shift in dates. It means that when we have the gallery visit next week, then there's another week where we're going to deal with Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and then your essay is due the following week. I think that's a bit tight. So I'm going to extend the essay a week. I'll write a note about that to Leo so everybody knows. You've got an extra week to go.
So it's due the 23rd instead of the 16th.
Correct. Is that right? Whatever it is, it's a week later than whatever it says.
Last week you said it was the 16th. You changed it to the 16th.
Whatever it was, it's a week later. I haven't got the... Let me have a look, quick look. Yep, that's right. 23rd of September. Thank you. So there's a rather distorted picture of Brett Whiteley in the top right. There's my friend William Blake and David Malouf and Patrick White. And there's quite a few little grains of sand. So here is alchemy. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to explore the way in which Brett Whiteley, and then I'm going to touch briefly on David Malouf because we're coming to him later, the way that the ordinary is seen as the source of the extraordinary, and how the grain of sand is, both for William Blake and for Brett Whiteley, their way of alluding to the sacred which is embodied here in the ground under our feet. At the centre of Brett Whiteley's 18-panelled painting Alchemy, he includes this image of himself, which I showed you last week, holding a magnifying glass, looking down at a grain of sand. There it is. And this becomes, in a way, a metaphor for the whole of Brett Whiteley's creative output. The transformation of the finest elements of experience from the coarsest through the power of the creative imagination. There it is in context. I was fortunate enough to be able to get permission to go down and take close-up photographs of the whole of that painting, which I'm going to use for an article shortly. But I'll be putting them all online. I've got to try and sort them all out and connect them together as best I can. There's the grain of sand here. And you will appreciate that Brett Whiteley was not only a mystic, but he was a sensualist. And there's just naked women and sex on all his canvases, everywhere. Everywhere you look. Part of his obsession. And, you know, there's so much to read in his paintings when you look closely at them. You know, here's a telescope behind moving and exclamation marks referring to, well, who knows what, and there's an image of Brett Whiteley with his dog heading off to Europe with a suitcase in his hand. There's a whole kind of autobiography written into these paintings. There he is. There's Blake's grain of sand, a little close-up. Whiteley worked for a year on this painting between 1972 and 1973. And the title of the painting, Alchemy, refers to the 16th century sacred science. Alchemy is a 16th century sacred science, which on the physical level sought to transform base metal into gold. But that was really a metaphor or a symbol for a deeper spiritual purpose behind alchemy, for hermetic and esoteric seekers. Alchemy was the science of the inner life, the transformation of lead into gold in human nature. And Whiteley's painting here, and perhaps all of his art, is an autobiographical visualization of such a transformation, celebrating many aspects of earthly existence, from sexual intercourse and birth through to death. It's all there in the painting. And he also focused at the same time on all the wonders of nature that he saw around him. He was passionate about the bush. He was passionate about nature in all its aspects. You know, you've got the blue wren here, the wallaby, all the kind of icons of a bush scene. In the middle of it, you've got an actual human brain encased in fiberglass, with a yin and a yang symbol on top of it. It's an actual human brain. It's not something that anybody's produced out of one of these new 3D printers. It's an actual human brain, pickled in formaldehyde. So, you know, Whiteley was a sculptor as well as an artist in many ways. Quite incredible what he attempts to do through his artwork. And his paintings are full of quotations. Now, I'm going to be putting into closed reserve. I bought these down at the Brett Whiteley Centre. There's a complete panorama and a description of every plate on the back. You can buy that down there. It's about $10. And I'm going to put this into closed reserve for a two-hour loan for those of you who want it. And then in addition to that, there is the notebooks, the scratch pads that he kept as he was creating it, full of lots of the quotations that you actually find on the painting. So there's a PhD awaiting somebody here if you want to go in and analyse a 20th century artistic brain. And while I'm thinking of it, I haven't done this before, I've just realised today I missed out on handing this round. This is a facsimile of the Songs of Innocence and Experience.
Okay.
Worth about $9,000, I joke. Yes. I joke. You can just pass that round and have a look. So, one of the great icons in the middle of his Australian landscape section is this wonderful presentation of the lyrebird. And the lyrebird in many ways is like a symbol really for his whole artwork, his ability to ventriloquize and to speak in so many different tongues. How many of you heard a lyrebird in Sydney? A few of you, yeah. You know, they imitate 20, 15, 10 birds at a time. And they even imitate human sounds, people playing flutes or people using a chainsaw. So they are a miraculous kind of vehicle for transforming and producing sounds, the lyrebird. As well as, you know, immediate things in his environment, he also included many things that had influenced him in the past and many aspects of history, ancient and modern. And one of the artists that deeply affected him was the artist Hieronymus Bosch, B-O-S-C-H. B-O-S-C-H, Hieronymus Bosch, a Dutch artist of the 16th century, who produced such images of hell, of kind of violence and distorted images. And Brett Whiteley really kind of drew on the influences of Hieronymus Bosch to depict aspects of the horror of the contemporary world as he saw it. And guess who this is? This is Patrick White, living in his little stone house in Castle Hill. We'll be coming to Patrick White. Patrick White was a close friend of Brett Whiteley's. Patrick White looked out from his house at Castle Hill on what he described the spiritually dead landscape. But he was determined to stay in Australia and transform that landscape through his writing into a landscape which showed that you could discover the extraordinary in the ordinary. So he chose some of the most downtrodden, outcast characters, like an Aboriginal who was dying of syphilis and tuberculosis, but who was also an artist, and showed that through this person's soul, beauty was born. Or he took, an inconsequential woman, Miss Hare, who seemed to be totally dysfunctional in society, and showed that she had a vision of the world that no one else had. And of course, Patrick White himself, sort of incarcerated within this house, was himself an outcast. He was actually brought up in a very wealthy family, but back in the 1950s and the early 60s, if you dared to declare that you were gay, you were shut out. And that was his problem. He was shut out. He felt kind of, he experienced the, being an outcast, and so he kind of identified with outcasts in his own world. Things would have been very different for him nowadays, but it was pretty tough then.
Still the same in some families, Mark.
Still the same in some families. True, very true. Now, within the painting, when you look close up, there are also many images of the horrors that the world was going through in the 60s and the 70s, with the Vietnam War, with President Nixon, with all sorts of, with Mao Zedong. You know, if you're a historian or if you wanted to go in and look literally at all the various images and figures and things, it's all explained. A lot of it's explained on the back of that, the sheets that I've shown you there. And at the end of the series is this image of alchemical transformation, the transmutation from coarse into fine. It actually moves here into Whiteley's passion for the wisdom of the Far East. He was very interested in Zen Buddhism. He was interested in all forms of Zen meditation. But interestingly, for this last panel, he focused on the Nobel Prize nominated Japanese author Yukio Mishima. Brilliant novelist who, for whatever reason, I can't go into it here, for when it committed ritual suicide after writing his 14th novel or something. And the white light emanating from the panel here flows through this ineffable landscape of gold in a Japanese screen where there are floating bonsais representing Mishima's spirit leaving his body. A physical death and a spiritual birth. You know, you could read it in all sorts of ways. You could almost read it maybe as a prefiguring of Whiteley's own death, although Whiteley's own death was tragically accidental. There was nothing deliberate about it at all. So as well as the flora and the fauna, the painting is scattered with images of writers and artists who had a formative influence on Whiteley. Van Gogh, James Joyce, Arthur Rimbaud, Charles Baudelaire, Bob Dylan, British artist Francis Bacon, Patrick White, etc. Now, near the very centre, and you might have seen this when I showed you the full extended painting, in the very centre there's one panel which has it on it. It doesn't have those words on it. That's superimposed those words on it. And next to it, right next to it, the panel is this Brett Whiteley with Blake's grain, pointing down to Blake's grain of sand, the sight line going down to Blake's grain of sand. About this panel, it, Whiteley wrote in his notebook the following. He said, "It is completely linguistically indescribable. In the painting, it is like the alchemical fulcrum between the visceral world, the sensual human world, emerging from blue sea and sky, which is all what you get over here, through to the transformation into molten gold." And the grain of sand, it's referred to as the grain of sand. So it's an intertextual allusion to those lines. An intertextual allusion to those lines. And of course, Whiteley's painting is a text. All paintings are texts. Whiteley's painting is more text than most paintings, in the sense that it's got a lot of text buried in it, and text informs it and surrounds it. So the intertextual allusion is to those lines that you all know off by heart now. "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." Whiteley himself has not written explicitly about what he means. Now that just leads me to another thing here. I'm also going to put into closed reserve today this book here, Brett Whiteley, Art, Life and the Other Thing. It's a brand new issue of a biography of him, which has a whole chapter in it called Alchemy. So that'll go into a 2-hour loan as well. So Whiteley hasn't himself explained what those lines mean, but it's clear that it's the grain of sand, because it's so tiny and because it's got a picture of Whiteley with a suitcase and a dog and a label on it saying, "I'm going to Europe," it's a humorous, partly serious allusion to the profound respect accorded to Blake's visionary imagination by the Beat generation, of which Whiteley felt himself very much a part. Now, Whiteley actually met Allen Ginsberg on the island of Hydra in the 1960s with Leonard Cohen. So, you know, talk about name dropping. But there he was with Leonard Cohen and Allen Ginsberg on the island of Hydra. And you all now know already Ginsberg's famous Paris Review essay written in 1966, My Vision of Blake, where Ginsberg speaks of Blake representing, quoting, the total consciousness then of the complete universe, a breakthrough from ordinary consciousness into consciousness that was really seeing all of heaven in a flower, heaven in a grain of sand. And earlier in the same essay, Ginsberg had said, Blake had penetrated the very secret core of the entire universe and had come forth with some little magic formula statement in rhyme and rhythm that, if properly heard in the inner ear, would deliver you beyond the universe. Whiteley's portrait of himself at the centre of alchemy, with a white flap that opens and closes on his face, giving access to Blake's grain, which is positioned as the atomic nucleus of this alchemical celebration of the journey from life to death. Might closing the flap be a way of shutting out the full impact and significance of that sacred connection? Now, here's one of Whiteley's journal entries that he produced in that collection of journal entries there. The fine art of painting, which is the bastard of alchemy, always has been and always will be a game. The rules of the game are quite simple. In a given arena, on as many psychic fronts as the talent allows, one must visually describe the centre of the meaning of existence. That's Brett Whiteley. And Brett Whiteley, in this book, actually, it's interesting, he's interviewed, and he says that he had a real passionate attempt through this work of art to find a key that unlocked the universe. But he feels that he didn't get there. And it comes through in this comment here, the fine art of painting, a bastard of alchemy, always has been, always will be a game. So there's an interesting question in my mind about the relationship between art and enlightenment. You know, many of the great enlightened people in the world, the mystics, the meditators, the Julians of Norwich, the Dalai Lamas, they're not artists, but they reach something. And then there are a lot of artists in the world, musicians, poets, painters, who are reaching for something. That's their passion. It's what drives them. To what extent do they feel they reached there? Interesting question. You know, human creativity is an incredibly powerful instrument. We all have it, and we all will use it in our life in various ways. Brett Whiteley himself, in the film we're going to see shortly, he sort of fears his own creativity and tries to kind of hold it so that it doesn't destroy him. Eventually it did destroy him. So there's something whimsical in this comment that reminds me of some of the prose passages in Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, where Blake also treats the deadly serious with a kind of self-deflating humour. The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, as we'll see, is very comic in many sections. Here's another quote from Brett Whiteley's journal. Must find the middle ground between celestial and terrestrial. That's between heavenly and earthly. Nothing waits at the centre of the brain except death. But the seeking out of the Sophia in the mind, the Sophia is wisdom. Seeking out of the Sophia in the mind, the priestess of the hidden one. So this is going over terrain that we already know about. For William Blake to see a grain, heaven in a grain of sand, the orgies of innocence, they evoke a quality of consciousness that is at the core of Blake's whole creative output. A consciousness, quoting again from Ginsberg, that was really seeing heaven in a grain of sand. And it seems to me that Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, for example, explore states of being that either are or are not attuned to such a consciousness. So we've already gone over the two nurses' songs that dramatise the polarity of these two states. In the former, the nurse is described, "My heart is at rest within my breast and everything else is still." And she's able to allow the children under her care to continue playing outside in the twilight. The little ones leaped and shouted and laughed, and all the hills echoed. So visually, in Blake's engraving, the colourful children are dancing in a circle in front of the nurse's stable, harmonious form. And the twirling, pendulous shapes of nature appear to carry and support the lines of the text and the song. For all its simplicity, for all the joy that comes out of it, the nurse's state is depicted as the fruit of an inner act of containment, of balance. The contrast to what is represented here, we've also gone over this before, is the nurse's song in Experience. This engraving immediately gives the impression of restriction and control rather than openness. The young boy is about to endure a grooming to his hair. The girl seems bowed and disconsolate, awaiting the tedium of day at school. This nurse shows bodily tension and a concern for outward appearances. Nature in this image is controlled. Grapevines climb trellises on the constructed doorframe. Here there is a distinct absence of the condition evoked in "My heart is at rest within my breast and everything else is still." And the words of this poem reveal a state that's contaminated with subterranean jealousies. Is this why the second nurse has the impulse to create a conformable exterior appearance? Nothing is relaxed and at ease in this image, or in the words that arise when the voices of children are heard on the green and whisperings are in the dale. "The days of my youth rise fresh in my mind, my face turns green and pale." The filaments of internal disorder and their impact on the external world are sharply etched in the way that the colour green in this poem is contextually polluted, becoming the colour of jealousy. Inevitably, the impulse of the second nurse's song is to do the opposite of the nurse in Innocence, to restrict and control. She's got no intimacy with herself, and she's not able to extend this to her children in her care. "Come home, my children, the dews of night arise." So in this poem, a version of the last stanza of the previous poem, in which the children were dancing and singing, is cut. The poem finishes abruptly with an allusion to a joyless, cold and dark world. "Your spring and your day are wasted in play, and your winter and night in disguise." This is a world in which the sacred has been extinguished by a disconnection from the ground of being. The nurse's state of being is also connected with that sense of awe and wonder and an openness to impressions that William Blake demonstrated so beautifully in that poem that we saw in the letter that he wrote to Thomas Butts. We saw it last week. This is the first time that Blake had left London for any length of time. "To my friend Butts I write, my first vision of light on the yellow sand sitting. The sun was emitting his glorious beams from heaven's high streams, over sea, over land. My eyes did expand into regions of air, away from all care, into regions of fire, remote from desire. The light of the morning, heaven's mountain adorning in particles bright, the jewels of light distinct, shone and clear. Amazed and in fear, I each particle gazed, astonished, amazed. For each was a man, human form, swift I ran. For they beckoned to me, remote by the sea, saying, each grain of sand, every stone on the land, each rock and each hill, each fountain and rill, each herb and each tree, Mountain, hill, earth and sea, cloud, meteor and star are men seen afar. My eyes more and more, like a sea without shore, continue expanding. So this poem, for all its simplicity, evokes an experience filled with joy and awe of awakening to the beauty of the immediate tangible world and to a sense of the ineffable. Ineffable is that which is kind of beyond the mundane, the ineffable within and beyond this world. It's an experience that ultimately brings Blake back strongly to his own body and to his experience of being a child in that body. Blake would refer to this quality of seeing as fourfold vision, as opposed to the single vision of the scientist and the materialist, and that's what he attacks so strongly in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, when he's talking about opening the doors of perception. As we're going to see, the Australian author who most embraced this quality of Blakean visionary seeing grounded in the minutiae of nature is David Malouf, particularly in his novel Remembering Babylon. I just want to make a very brief connection with that novel now, which we'll be coming to in 4 weeks' time. There's this little passage near the start of the novel where one of the characters, Janet, who is very closely connected with Jemmy Fairley, has this experience when she got up and walked into the paddock and all the velvety grass heads blazed up, haloed with gold. She felt under the influence of her secret skin suddenly floaty, as if she had been relieved of the weight of her own life, and the brighter being in her was very gently stirring and shining its wings, shifting its wings. That's at the end of chapter 5 in the book. We will come and look at that closely in weeks to come. So that's all I'm going to do there about that. We're just going to have a little look at Brett Whiteley himself and see what he says about alchemy, and says a little bit about his own early life and why he was painting in the way that he did. Now that is actually the studio that we're going to see next week. Is actually outside the studio. Jess, could you turn the lights off at the back, thanks? The studio was bought by the state government after he died and turned into a part of the National Gallery.
Piece of paper or a canvas. When do you stop distorting? When there's no end to distortion once you start? Or when do you stop trying to be real when there is no absolute reality, that no matter how real you make it, it still could be realer? How little and how many colours should one use? Ultimately, what's it trying to convey, and to whom? How much is it worth, and for how long does it mean what it means now? Painting is an argument between what it looks like and what it means. Form versus content. When it's finished, there shouldn't be any part of this picture that's really is any more important than any other. But it's a very exciting stage of a drawing because it's very malleable. It's, you know, almost like clay. And the push-pull sense of it is, it's a pleasure at this stage. It'll get harder once it arrives at that point where it's not finished and it'll need violating in order to sort of uplift it, to take it into the next, to get more power into it. Conceived the idea. I naively still believe that a work of art, a powerful Guernica type work of art, if you could produce a picture which was so anti-war, so repugnant, that it would shake the complacency and shake people out of war. And I produced this picture called The American Dream, which started off with what I dreamed of, a tranquil, Eden-like Pacific Island, peaceful landscape. And then it moves slowly and inevitably to a kind of apocalyptic, cathartic heart attack or breakdown, which I was imminently moving towards and the country was moving towards. It's a very, very powerful picture. There were sirens and it had music to it, recordings of television recording. I mean, it was just using every possible medium. And I finally arrived at a point where I couldn't hold New York any longer or this picture. Marlborough refused to show it. They thought it was too socially too much involved with politics, and politics and art don't happily mix. So I fled. I just got on an airplane and I left the picture there and eventually brought it out to Australia and showed it, and it's in the Western Australian Gallery now.
You once said, well, it's sort of not
but the 60s at that stage was experimental and it was liberating. There was a lot of dope being taken and a lot of adventure. I mean, it was a wonderful party, really.
This painting is about one third. The rest of the picture would extend to the full length of this room, of Alchemy, which was a painting I started in early 1974. During a fairly emotional and turbulent sort of point of my life and my marriage, and I spent about a year on it. I was still, when I began Alchemy, enormously involved with the proposition of surrealism and being able to tap the subconscious and convey that visually. I was still very much into that notion that by a total derangement of the senses, and that in a sense is that if you could know more by drinking petrol, you would attempt that you would use poison.
poisons or chemicals or any degree of experience in order to attain a higher consciousness about reality.
Sometimes while working this picture, I really believe that I was on the verge of the acquisition of some extraordinary new knowledge and sense and power.
I wanted the picture to work from a great distance so that these immense sweeps and linear connections would work from 80 paces, and equally as much I wanted to have such fine detail. I even imagined magnifying glasses hanging off it on chains, where you would come into a form and be invited to even go further and further in, that I would get down to such a microcosm of detail at certain points and then quickly open the space out. And it's no use me rationally trying to explain why that image is sitting against another image. I wanted to try and get to a dream state that one single absolute image couldn't hold. It only, as in dreams, the way that one envelopes quickly into a completely different thought pattern, I wanted to try and convey that and also excite myself visually with the notion of the unexpected. And in many ways, it frightens me to do very much on it, because I don't want to reopen the state of mind that I was in when I painted it, because it was a very it took a considerable mental and physical toll on me doing this picture. I mean, surrealism or any degree of avant-garde always breaks the room. There's half the people that understand it and the other half who don't, so you immediately get the possibility of misunderstanding. And I think it very much with an enigmatic work like alchemy. It's a bit like trying to describe to somebody, you know, what is 1 foot? You know, it's all relative, really. I mean, there's an exact... That's a foot. 12 inches. This is the third attempt at a portrait of Francis. In the 70s, I did a series of one-off silk screen.
So that's a little glimpse there. I haven't decided whether I'm going to put this DVD in the library yet. It was the only copy I've been able to get. If I could copy it, I might put a copy in there. So I haven't agreed on that yet. Couple of things out of that. What was said about the tension between art and politics. I mean, that's very central to Blake's whole experience, that he was working in an environment where politics were, in a way, a kind of a driving force for his creativity. And he was trying to both make a sense of and challenge the political dimensions of his time. But that was quite an extraordinary video, that. It's amazing that we've got it, especially those clips of Brett Whiteley actually there painting, you know, in black and white, engaged in it, and then his own commentary on it afterwards. I happened to see that video, glimpsed it at an exhibition of Brett Whiteley's, which was on in the Newcastle Art Gallery a few months ago. So certainly worth knowing about. So I want to move now to Blake's Book of Job, which you've got quite a bit of stuff in Leo here. Look, you've got the Book of Job, the whole book here full of slides and interpretations of all the various images in there. The Book of Job was written or produced near the end of Blake's life. And let me just find the fine file here. Okay. I've just drawn out or highlighted the key moments in it. When we go to the gallery, they're going to have the 21 plates arranged for us around the room, and they're the original plates. I can't remember how many sets there are, but there are not many sets in the world. And it was Blake's young artist friend John Linnell who asked Blake to produce this set. Blake had been interested in Job since the beginning of his life, and he had done a number of watercolours on the Job series. I'll just show you one of the watercolours that he did early. That's one of the watercolours that he'd done earlier. And the watercolours are quite spectacular, really, in their colour. This is where Job reaches the point of hearing the angels and the stars singing in heaven. So Blake had been interested in Job since the beginning of his life, and it's not hard to see why Blake was interested particularly in Job. Because Job was a man who was much maligned. Job was a man who was abused, and Blake felt some kinship with Job's experience. And so Blake was interested, really very interested, in the story of how Job came to kind of be reconciled to his own difficulties in life. But Blake took the Old Testament Job story and transformed it in many ways. Not only did he interleave into it stories from the New Testament, because Job, of course, is an Old Testament book, but he brought into it certainly aspects of his own belief about what it was that could help human beings make a connection with the divine in themselves. So the book is the book, Blake's book of Job, is like a teaching series of images, all with texts around them. And that's a sort of a link there with Brett Whiteley. Brett Whiteley is not just a visual artist, he's a textual and a visual artist, just like Blake was. Although the emphasis in Brett Whiteley was more on the image, Blake, the emphasis is probably more on the text. What I've just done here, I've just arranged for you the six or seven plates that to me are the most important. They're all important, but these are the stepping stones that give you a kind of a clear insight into what Blake's take is on the Job story. So in this first plate, Job is presented as a very pious father who is an adherent of the local church. There's the church in the background, and with his children around him. But the one really significant symbolic detail in this engraving is the musical instruments, which are up in the tree, but they're out of reach, and they don't even seem to know that they're there. So that's an important detail. It's important when you look at the very last painting, where the musical instruments are taken down and are played. And for Blake, this was a symbol of the difference between a religion that was purely of the word, purely rational, and lacked engagement with the arts, with the imagination, with music, and so on. Now, in this, Blake incorporates actual texts from the Old Testament, but he incorporates other things. And one important thing here, he's written here, the letter killeth. The letter killeth. If you look in your own, you don't have it in your text, do you? The letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. The letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. So that's a real clue to what Blake's position is right at the start. That there's something kind of negative and perhaps out of touch with this form of worship. And when you look at the last painting, you will realise that the sun is setting over here. The setting sun, suggesting that this form of worship is coming to an end. Now this brings in a whole context of Blake's religious beliefs at the time, which is a study in itself, but certainly is there as part of the background to The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And if you go to the library and borrow this from Closed Reserve and read even the first 10 pages in here, it gives you a beautiful synopsis of where Blake's religious affinities were. Because Blake was living at a time in the 1780s, 1790s, when there was tremendous global upheaval, equivalent to the global upheaval that we're perhaps experiencing today, certainly that Brett Whiteley experienced in the 60s, perhaps more than today. And along with that global upheaval, there comes a great deal of religious uncertainty. And people lose their faith, they do this, they do that, they don't know where to turn. That's part of the human phenomena of religious experience in times of social and political upheaval. Nowadays, you know, with all competing religions and violence around the world that many people say is inspired by religion, there's a tremendous sort of uncertainty about religious adherence. It's not surprising that in these times you get new prophets and new paths. One of the great new prophets in Blake's time was Emanuel Swedenborg. Emanuel Swedenborg was a Swedish scientist and a visionary. And he'd written a book called Heaven and Hell, actually. And believe it or not, Swedenborg lived in London just before Blake, during Blake's childhood. And he died before Blake reached maturity. But Swedenborg had founded a new church in London based on his teachings. And Blake's own family, his parents, had never been adherents to traditional church. They'd always been what's called nonconformist. And as the film on Blake that we saw a few weeks ago said, after Blake's baptism in that church in London, he never entered a church proper again. And that's true, he never did. But he and his wife Catherine did belong to the Swedenborg Church, if you can call it a church. And they went along to Swedenborgian meetings, and Blake was very influenced by the various nonconformist thinkers and writers at that time, and he would have learned a great deal from them about Neoplatonism and all the various other undercurrents. And in fact, in one of his letters, he says that he was very influenced by Berman and Paracelsus, as well as by Shakespeare and Milton. And Berman and Paracelsus are two of the sort of mystics of the medieval period, or mystical scientists. Paracelsus was actually an alchemist. But Blake was never to be tied down by anything. He said famously in the book Jerusalem, I must create my own system and not be tied down by that of another man's. And that really was how he was. He did not want to be constrained by anybody's system. He wanted to, in a sense, find and discover his own path. And he did. One has to say that he did. So it was fairly early on in the 1790s that Blake and Catherine actually broke away from the Swedenborgian church. And it was then that he conceived the marriage of heaven and hell. So the marriage of heaven and hell was partly inspired by and partly a reaction to what he'd learnt from Swedenborg. So that complicates our reading of the text. And that complicates anybody's reading of the text. As I said to one person the other day, this text is probably the most difficult text that you're likely to read, even though it's only 10 pages long. It's got so many different contexts in it, but this is not to be alarmed about. It's to be fascinated by the range of interpretations and the range of levels that a literary stroke artistic text can have. So if you come out of this course, come out of your work on the marriage of heaven and hell with a thoughtful and an approach to the text that realizes that you're not going to be able to extract all the meaning from this simply and easily, but it exists there as something that's going to tantalize you for the rest of your life, and there are aspects of it that you can immediately can connect with, and there are ideas and phrases and images that you think are fantastic, but as a whole you're going to be looking out for that article that's going to be written in 2040 by somebody who's cracked the code and been able to link all the things together. And there have been writers who've come up in the last 50 years saying, I've cracked the code. No, you haven't, mate. I've cracked the code. No, you haven't, mate. And this guy here, he thinks he's cracked the code now. But he's rather cautious. He sort of looks at all the codes that have been cracked. The chap in the back of our book here, what's his name? Nermi. He certainly thinks he's cracked the code. It's a good code he's got. It puts a nice structure over the poem. But does it take everything into account? Now, how did I get distracted from Job into that?
Does Blake himself know what the code is?
Well, let me tell you here that David Maloof, who, as you know, is a frequent visitor to this campus, he usually, you know, blows the socks off students when a student asks him, now, what do you mean by that particular episode? And he stands there and says, I know nothing about my book. You know what my book means. I just wrote it. And Brett Whiteley said the same thing there. Don't ask me what I meant there. You know, artists work, as you know, I'm sure, artists work at a level of consciousness that is not sort of rationally explicable all the time. So it's not quite a fair question to ask, did he know? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright. Did William Blake know what he was asking? So, interesting questions. So, I expanded this a little bit. Here you can see the letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. It is spiritually discerned. Spiritually discerned. That word spiritual is an interesting word. Spirituality is a word that many traditional churches run away from because they can't contain it. They don't know how to deal with it. Spirituality, come and learn the Gospels. Come and study the Bible. Spirituality, whoa. Careful, things slipping under my feet. Spiritually discerned. Blake believed in, it connects in with David's question. It connects with what we apprehend deeply at an emotional, bodily level, perhaps not with the intellect alone. And this is the last plate. This is the last plate. Where are the musical instruments in the trees here? Where are they? In the people's hands. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than the beginning. So that's plate 21. And it's worth looking at the words around them. Now you've got all this on Leo. You can look at it all up there. So that's the shift or the transformation from the early Job to the late Job. And it's just worth pointing out that the Job at the end of the series is very like the voice of the ancient bard in this poem that we just looked at briefly last week. The voice of the ancient bard, which is the last poem in the Songs of Experience. Youth of delight, come hither and see the opening morn. Image of truth newborn. Doubt is red and clouds of reason. Dark disports and artful teasing. Folly is an endless maze. Tangled mats perplex her ways. How many have fallen there? The rumble all night. I can't read that up there. Let me get the text in here. Too blurred. Tangle roots perplex her ways. How many have fallen there? They stumble all night over bones of the dead and feel they know not what but care and wish to lead others when they should be led. So he's talking here about the dispelling of the clouds of reason, of disputes, folly, and he's talking about the opening morn and the image of truth that comes through the voice of the bard. And of course the bard is not only the prophetic voice, but it's the singer, the person who's connected to song with all that that means of harmony and connection with artistry. Now this plate 7 is the stage in Job's story.
Sorry.
Yep. What are we doing?
I went around the whole class.
You went, couldn't find a seat.
No, sorry.
In plate 7, the story of Job is that Job had a number of friends and because Job was being submitted to so many ailments, he had boils on his skin, he's lost his daughters, these terrible things happened to Job. If you don't know the story of Job yet, you better look it up in Wikipedia. But Job was, you know, he was the victim of Satan's opportunity or attempt to show God that he could destroy Job's faith by abusing him in every possible way. And Job had to submit to all these terrible things that happened to him. And his moralistic friends said, the reason you're like that, Job, is because you're a bad man. You better wake up to yourself and be a good man. And so they're all pointing at him and accusing. Job is being accused by his friends for, immorality that's led to this downfall. And this is, of course, Blake's attack on, you know, conventional Christian views that people who have terrible sufferings, it's the result of their evil that's led to that. So that's part of the journey that Blake shows in the panel. And then in plate 11, there's this terrible dream that Job has. He has a dream that God is suffocating him. But the God that's presented here is actually Satan. You can see by the cloven hoof. This is the deepest, terrible part of Job's journey, where it's as if he's being consumed by the forces of evil. And it's at the bottom of this plate 11 there that is described something that really kind of kicks in with an understanding of why Blake himself was drawn to this whole story. It says, with dreams upon my bed thou searest me and affrightest me with visions. Why do you persecute me as God and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand in the latter days upon the earth. And after my skin destroy thou this body, yet in my flesh shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another, though consumed by my wrought lineage, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or is worshipped. So the lines that strike a chord with me is that in the book of Job, Job actually says that what he's going through, the suffering that he's going through, and his sense that his faith is not going to be disturbed by that suffering, leads to him wanting to write a book where the story is graven with an iron pen. And this must have caught Blake's attention, that he wanted to also grave Blake's story with an iron pen. I should say that in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and in nearly all Blake's prophetic books, Blake used the method of engraving that he describes in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is the illuminated engraving where he took a sheet of copper and drew on that sheet of copper with a substance that was acid resistant. So he drew his text in mirror writing and the images in an acid resistant substance. And then framed that piece of brass with a frame and poured acid on top of it. And the acid ate away everything that was not the text and not the image. It ate it away. And then he poured the acid away, and if necessary, he put a bit more of the acid-resistant material if it had gone in areas that he didn't want it to. And he put the acid on again, and it burnt the text away. That's why in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, just to recap, he says in plate 15, I think it is. No, it's plate 14. He says, the notion that man has a body distinct from the soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method by corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which was hid. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Melting apparent surfaces away to display the infinite which was hid. That is the line which summarizes the whole of William Blake's life's work. All his life's work in his writing and in his imagery was a process of melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which was hid. That's what he did in the two nurses' poems. He contrasted the two nurses' experiences, he wrote about them, and he metaphorically showed his readers what was needed to be burnt away in the nursing experience so that she could have an open heart to connect herself with the universe, to connect herself with the children. So that method of printing, which is referred to by Blake as, what does he refer to it? Illuminated printing, is the way that he did most of his work. The other way of printing that was common before Blake's time was called intaglio. And intaglio, I-N-T-A-G-L-I-O. Intaglio was where you actually scraped into the copper. You scraped into the copper and wrote your words in the copper. The problem with that is that you couldn't really scrape images too well. And Blake wanted to be able to be in control of creating the images and the text. The Job series were done in the intaglio method. I'm not quite sure the reason why he chose to do that for this particular series. Okay, this plate here, which I think is it's plate 12, is the cornerstone of the Job series. And I'm sure you'll all want to go and have a closer look at this one. A young man comes to Job and tells Job not to listen to what his friends on earth have said about his morals, but Job needs to awaken to the fact that the divine can be apprehended through dreams and the imagination. And this is a kind of a turning point for Job. Suddenly he's kind of shifted out of his more rationalistic world with his rationalistic friends, and he's opened really to a Blakean view of how the divine is acknowledged. And that's through imagination and through vision. And in the series, it's after this point that Job suddenly experiences God in a different dimension. He has an experience of God coming in a whirlwind. He has a physical experience of this. He has an experience of the stars singing in the heavens. In fact, Job is becoming very Blakean in the way that he sees the world. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Now, if you actually read the book of Job in the Old Testament, then the latter part of the book of Job, where Job actually describes his own awakening, is not far removed from what Blake describes. Job's descriptions of the incomprehensible beauty of the universe, incomprehensible creations in the universe, like huge beasts, like the behemoth and the leviathan, like the movements of the planets in the heavens, the movements of the stars. Job's poetry in the book of Job is a poetry which takes us beyond any rational explanation of God. And the book of Job is one of the most poetic books in the Old Testament, and really, in a sense, affirms the fact that the divine, the ineffable, can only be perceived through the sort of attunement that poetry and art can bring. And there's the watercolour that preceded that particular engraving. That's it. That's as much as I want to do there with the book of Job for the moment. Anybody got any questions at all? Any questions about anything? Stunned you all into silence.
Have you ever looked at the verse Isaiah 35:5?
Yep.
And related this back to...
Tell us about it.
Well, it talks about... the glory of the Lord being revealed.
Yep.
Says, they will see the glory of the Lord and the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with feeble hearts, be strong and do not fear. Your Lord will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like seeing beyond.
Yeah, yeah, good. That shows a sort of a context from where Blake himself got his thoughts about opening the doors of perception.
Yeah.
It's not something he invented, it's something that he kind of felt his own way through the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
Blog post this week.
It's in your blog post this week.
No, it will be.
Oh, it will be. Oh, very good. I'll make a special effort to have a look at it. Any other comments or questions? Good. Well, let's go to the marriage of heaven and hell now. How are we doing? 11:25. Wow, we've got about 10 minutes on the marriage of heaven and hell. Wonderful. But I did the main things for today. The main things for today are getting you ready for the Job and getting you ready for the Brett Whiteley. And now we're going to have a look. We're going to have a go. Let's begin our work on the marriage of heaven and hell.
Oh, there you go.
Yep, go.
Well, he's referring to Isaiah 34 and 35.
In the beginning of the
introduction.
That's right, he does. We're going to look at that in tutorials today. So that would be good. So this slide here just gives you a little bit of the context of the political context for the marriage of heaven and hell. The French Revolution occurred in 1789, the storming of the Bastille and the violence on the streets of Paris. That was the year that the Songs of Innocence was produced, so already it was produced before the full impact of the French Revolution had made its appearance. The Songs of Experience then, 1793, appeared around about the same time as the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And at the bottom of the screen there, 1792, there was Pitt's Reign of Terror. William Pitt, he was the Prime Minister of England at the time. It was a Reign of Terror. It was a Reign of Terror. It was a bit like, you know, what happened in the United States in the 50s. There were door knocks from door to door. Police would come and interrogate people, and we know about the story of Blake being accused of sedition for his attack on a soldier in Felpham. So Blake was very much living in fear of those sorts of things being imposed on him and him being denied the opportunity to write his work. And he was a friend of Thomas Paine, who wrote The Rights of Man. Thomas Paine fled to America. The Rights of Man was published, but Thomas Paine was, you know, he would be hung if he was caught. He fled to America. And it was at this time that Mary Wollstonecraft wrote The Rights of Women at the same time. She was a friend of William Blake's. William Blake actually illustrated some of her books for him, Mary Wollstonecraft. And the date there is actually incorrect. It's the assumed date, but as this book argues, you know, historical evidence would suggest strongly that because Blake didn't put his name to The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, it's the only book that he didn't put it to, that he was afraid that he would be accused of sedition if people found out what was in that book, especially the last part, The Song of Liberty. And in his manuscript notebook for June 1793, Blake wrote, "I say I shan't live 5 years, and if I live one, it will be a wonder." And that's the illustration that is at the front of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell.
published June 1793 by Blake in Lambeth. Our end is come. Three rather terrified-looking, seditious figures. Now, if you've read Nurmi, you'll know where this is coming from. And if you read some of the other articles that I've put up into Leo, you'll see more of this. But many people have seen this book as not having a tight structure, as being deliberately a scrapbook of Blake's philosophy with fractured discontinuities. Others have seen it as a kind of a holy satire on the works of Swedenborg. So there's many, many different views of it. Blake, at the bottom of the page there, he describes it as the Bible of hell, which the world will have whether they will or no. And there's also been quite some debate as to whether the Song of Liberty, at the end of The Marriage of Hell, whether it actually is part of that book or whether it's a separate work on its own. The current thinking is that it's very much part of the book as a whole. Now, I referred to this last week briefly, that in your text on page 360, Blake, at the same time, wrote a... not at the same time, a year earlier wrote this satire on English society. And the reason I mention this is because if you read even two pages of that satire, you'll see that the same kind of language there will find its way into The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. So what this series of slides that I'm doing here as an introduction to The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, it's just picking up some of the key ideas in this poem in inverted commas, because parts of it are prose passages, parts of it are poetry, so poem is not probably quite the right word. And in your text, if you turn to page 554, you'll see that Nurmi has got a whole first section called Blake's Ideal of Expanded Sense Perception. So that's a really important idea for Blake throughout. And in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, it comes up, of course, on page 71, which I was just reading from, right through to page 75. At the end of A Memorable Fancy on page 71, he has these lines: "How do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five?" So what's that question imply? What does it imply? Anybody have a guess at what that question might imply? How do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? What's that question mean? Any suggestions?
I'll put that here that it's a contrary. My notes when I read it.
Yep.
But I have no idea what I meant by that.
Well, when we see a bird, we assume that it is some lesser form of being. Blake is wanting to affirm the opposite, the contrary. That's probably what you meant. It's a little bit like the grain of sand. How can you know or not know that a bird flying through the air, full of song, full of colour, full of joy, how do we know or not know that it's not an immense world of delight to which we are completely closed off by our five senses?
We sort of limit the bird by what we can see and feel.
We limit everything by our own narrow consciousness. So it's an example or an image
within that memorable fancy. And he has a series of proverbs of hell which challenge all our conventional wisdom. A series of proverbs that take us through looking at all the things that we might be attached to and give us an alternative. And, you know, a lot of thought has gone into all the various meanings of each one of these proverbs. And they're the proverbs of hell, not necessarily because they are the voice of a devil or the voice of evil. In fact, quite the opposite in some cases. They're the voice of hell because they challenge the rigidity of the way that we see the world and the rigidity of our values. The fact that we're kind of stuck within certain conditioned views of things. And Blake is kind of looking at all the ways in which human beings are kind of closed off from a much larger worldview. And yeah, each one sort of cuts into that.
They expose reality, and it's the reality that we don't want to see.
That's it. Exactly. You know, you can pick ones out that sort of immediately touch your understanding, and others of them, I don't get that. You have to wait a long time. But, you know, for example, I just pick out here number 11. The busy bee has no time for sorrow.
I also have that picture.
You picked that one too?
Yeah.
The busy bee has no time for sorrow. And that applies to most of us, most of the time. The busy bee has no time for sorrow.
Because they are proverbs of hell and the voice of the devil.
Yep.
Does that mean that, I mean, in a way, does that mean they can't be fully trusted?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because I think within the context of the poem as a whole, of this poem as a whole, the voice of the devil is more trustworthy than the voice of the angel.
Mm. Yeah.
Blake presents us with, you know, a Pharisaical view of goodies. He presents the sort of traditional view of good as being hypocritical, Pharisaical.
Closed-minded.
What was that, David?
Closed-minded.
Bit like, you know, the priests in black gowns binding with briars my joys and desires. Blake's view of the traditional good is in fact evil. And so he brings in the devil as a counterweight to that. Not always, because in the book of Job, the devil is seen, or Satan is seen as a destructive force which Job has to break through. So Blake is not consistent there in that respect.
Would you say that these wouldn't actually be visions that he's actually had?
Well, they might be, that visions might have triggered them, but they might also be, you know, from his storehouse of proverbial knowledge.
Yeah.
Now, I hate
philosophical truths that he has come across.
Yeah. I hate to do this, but we're going to stop now. It's 11:37 and there's 2 hours of tutorial starting in 20 minutes. So we're going to stop now. We've got enough for this morning. I'm going to go straight into the marriage of heaven and hell in tutorials anyway, so we continue with this. And now remember, for next week, I've put up the address of where you have to go. 10 o'clock at the Brett Whiteley studio, and the entry fee is $11. Bring it with you. Okay? There's no entry fee for the art gallery after that. And bring your lunch with you if you want to have lunch in the Botanic Gardens after all our visits. Okay?
I've actually got a photography visit to the art gallery on the same day.
Fantastic. Not the same time, hopefully.
No, afterwards. Mm. So that worked out very well.
That worked out beautifully.
Thank you. downstairs?
No. No, you can buy it at the studio.
Ah, where we go.
But I'm going to put it into the library. So you can buy it in the studio.
And yeah. There's one in PDF, you said?
But I'm not sure. I don't think there is. I don't know about that. There might be. I've got one that I'm going to put into PDF.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yep, sure. Yep.
How did you say again?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
10 a.m.
So it goes for pretty much the whole length of the lecture tutorial.
Yeah, that's right.
On either.
Oh, no, that's blog posted.
Yeah,
only because I have a class like right after.
What time?
Right after our tutorial.
So you might have to leave a bit early. We could put you in the first class, because they're going to split anyway, probably, for the gallery. So we'll get there at, I think, 10, 11, 12. So you can come in the first class and leave about 12:30. All right?